Good morning. It is time to get up with Tua. 1 week from tonight, we find out the truth. But new information this morning on the one thing every team agrees upon. That's right off the top. Then, overnight, Vegas releases over-under win totals for every NFL team. How many do you think they're giving Tampa Tom? You'll find out. And Michael Jordan has plenty to say about Last Dance and his legacy. You'll hear it all directly from him a half hour from now as we get up with you, starting now on ESPN from Bristol. Mike Greenberg here and delighted that you are there. Thank you for getting up with us. And again, we begin every morning by saying first and foremost, and forever, thank you to all of you on the front lines of this pandemic. Thank you to the medical professionals and the first responders. Thank you for everything you're doing to keep us safe and healthy. It is our job to try and keep you entertained for the next 2 hours, and that's what we're going to do on a busy morning in sports. Let's get up and go, and we start in the NFL. Rams center Brian Allen told Fox Sports that he tested positive for COVID-19 last month. He is the first active NFL player to publicly announce that he has tested positive for the virus. Elsewhere, the Washington Post is reporting that among the many contingencies the NFL is considering includes plans to potentially shorten the season or play in either empty or partially filled stadiums. Much will depend on what other sports do. Speaking of other sports, Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred told the Associated Press the league must, quote, turn over every stone to try to play games in 2020. That, of course, is contingent on government and health officials giving the go-ahead. And then to soccer, where MLS is planning to postpone matches now through June 8th due to the pandemic. The league, which has been shut down since March 12th, previously had postponed the season through May the 10th. And then this news, the WWE announcing yesterday it is releasing 20 wrestlers and furloughing a portion of its workforce. The company had just been deemed an essential business in Florida, which allows it to resume its live television shows. And then our top story this morning, we are now 1 week away from the start of the 2020 draft, where we will find out which team will roll the dice on Tua Tagovailoa. Earlier this week, Mel Kiper Jr. dropped Tua a spot to number 6 in his latest mock draft. It would make him the third quarterback off the board behind Joe Burrow and Justin Herbert. However, our analytics at ESPN, the ESPN draft predictor, tells a very different story, continuing to believe the most likely landing spot for Tua is number 3 overall. And look at the difference between 3. Look at the likelihood there. His chance of being picked 6th is just 8%. So, some disagreement there. Let's get the latest from our Laura Rutledge, who's been as connected to this as literally anyone in the media or anywhere else. So, Laura, Tua's latest workout video was sent to every team in the NFL. From what you have heard, what has been the reaction?
Yeah, Greeny, it's been received very well. And continually, the teams that have always been interested in Tua and comfortable with the risk they may have to take to draft him continue to be interested and even more interested. A lot of teams said they really liked seeing consistent movement in this video here, as you can see it, and no favoritism on either leg. They also said, one team said specifically, that they liked that they could see two angles. So it wasn't just video from a cell phone or an iPad. You can really see how he's throwing it. They feel very comfortable now with what they've seen from him, if they're a team that's been interested all along. And now this is just a wait and see game for Tua. He feels like they've done everything they can to answer questions. Greeny, he's back at home in Alabama with his family. And as you said, a week away from the draft, one of the most anticipated drafts that I can remember in recent memory. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens with him on draft night.
No question. And quickly, I mean, you heard right off the top there that, as you well know, Mel now sees him dropping or hears of him dropping, while our analytics still have him going number 3. What does his team expect?
Well, look, you have to take everything right now with a grain of salt, certainly, because there's a lot of rumors that start circulating this close to the draft. I've heard similar things, that maybe Tua drops out of that 5th pick and goes maybe to the Chargers at the number 6 pick, just because the Miami Dolphins may be a team that are just more risk averse than other teams. Now, we'll see what happens there. They could be doing that to try and make sure that nobody trades up ahead of them to that 3 spot that our analytics predict to be important for Tua. So they feel very comfortable. They feel like Tua's camp has answered every single question that has been asked of them, and they feel that they've provided everything they can right now from an information standpoint.
All right, Laura, stay close. We'll come back to you in just a few minutes, but I want to bring Lewis Riddick and Bobby Bobby Carpenter into the conversation this morning. Gentlemen, great to see you both. And Lewis, I want to ask you the same question I just asked there. As one who has been involved in the manipulation of this system and putting teams together, our analytics have Tua going number three, or that the likeliest spot. We're hearing, Mel and others are hearing, that he's falling a little bit. How do you put those two pieces of information together?
Yeah, that's an interesting bit of information there for him to be going to number three to Detroit. That analytics feels as though that would be a good spot for him to go. And then, you know, as far as Mel is concerned, you know, putting Justin Herbert to Miami at five and having Tua drop number six to the Chargers, you know, as Laura just alluded to, that is strictly a function of whether or not people really believe that Miami is willing to take on that risk of drafting Tua without really having a real good up close and personal idea as to what his future availability projection is going to be. And that's simply what it comes down to. And I think for the Miami Dolphins, I think what it comes down to is this. And I think what it comes down to for any team that drafts Tua is this. You have to have total perfect alignment within your organization from ownership on down to take him or to pass on him. Because if you pass on him and he turns out to be the next Drew Brees, a la what the Miami Dolphins did before when Nick Saban was there, there's going to be people looking at you. And if you take him and he gets hurt, there's going to be people looking at you and you can't have any dissension. And I think that's really what it's coming down to. And if you can't really build that kind of consensus, Greeny, you're going to pass on him. Because when you're picking in the top 10 and in the top 5 in particular, you have to minimize as much risk as humanly possible. And I really think that's why the chatter is building up that maybe the Dolphins go with Herbert instead of Tua.
Yeah, it's interesting. And obviously, Bobby, that third pick wouldn't have to be the Lions taking him. It could forecast someone trading up there. So what is your sense of this? Again, the people who project this stuff for us think he's going number three, and everyone else seems to think he is dropping as we speak.
You know, I think the dropping thing is coming out right now because this is the time of the year. If you're the Miami Dolphins, you want people to believe that you're not going to take him. You want them to believe that there's going to be injury issues. And you do that to hopefully build yourself up to make sure that you necessarily don't have to go up to that number three spot. I don't think Miami wants to. I think they will if they have to. And like Lewis said, the alignment piece, like your owner has to be on board. We're not just talking about a top five pick. We're talking about a top five pick as a quarterback who's going to be the face of the franchise. And when that guy's going to be the face of the franchise, you need to make sure that your owner's on board, that any injury risk that's out there, he's comfortable with taking. And I ultimately feel Tua is going to go in the top five. I think Miami's going to probably have to trade up to three, but they're pushing all this out there. So when they're sitting there at about 8:20 and Washington's coming off the clock, they won't be antsy to have to go up and get him at three.
Hey, Lewis, let me ask you one more very quick thing, because you heard Laura allude to the tape and what the scouts saw, the evaluators saw that they liked in it. And we can maybe put the tape back up again really quickly here, that video that Tua sent out. Very quickly, Lewis, if you were looking at that, would you see enough in this to make you comfortable making the decisions you need to make?
Yeah, without having the chance to actually, you know, put him through a physical, sure. I mean, I see some things in there that really lead me to believe that he is really moving along quite well and quite nicely in his rehab. And all indications that I get from the people who are familiar with his rehab and who have seen some of the information believe that there isn't that much. Look, they feel comfortable. They would feel comfortable taking him in the top five. Now, I will say this, though, really quickly, that the teams that I have talked to and the people that I trust say this. I would take him, but I would not be willing to give up draft capital in order to move up to get him. That's why that pick there at number three, as you just alluded to, maybe it's not Detroit, maybe it's a team that moves in there. That's why that's very interesting, because I don't see a team moving in there to take him, but I do see a team sitting pat and seeing if people fall to him. I think that makes more sense to me.
That's a very important distinction. All right, very good. So we will see. Again, there's a week until that decision gets made. Meanwhile, I found this very interesting. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers, let's put them under a little bit of a spotlight here. They've obviously had a very busy offseason, as you were well aware. Gone is Jameis Winston, who threw a franchise record 33 touchdowns last year, but also became the first quarterback ever to throw 30 touchdowns and 30 picks in the same year. He's gone, and that is because this guy is on his way to town. Tom Brady, the six-time Super Bowl champion, leaving New England after 20 years. Brady will be 43 in August. He has a two-year deal with the Buccaneers, who also brought back a few key members from their defensive front seven. They put the franchise tag on Shaq Barrett. They re-signed defensive lineman Ndamukong Suh and Jason Pierre-Paul, among others. And all of that change leads us to their projected 2020 win total. I mentioned that Caesars put out all their over-unders, and according to Caesars, that total is set at 9. The last time the Bucs went over 9 wins was 2010, that season. Tom Brady has won over 9 games in 17 of the last 19 years. He's been a full-time starter. And so, Lewis, I come to you here because I just find these interesting. The Buccaneers won 7 games last year. You wonder, what is Tom Brady worth? You figure it's got to be worth something. Do you think this is a double-digit win team this season?
Yeah, I think they'll knock on the door of that. And I would pick over 9 for sure. And look, Jameis Winston, last year the Tampa Bay Buccaneers lost 2 one-score games in which he threw a pick six. So you know, I mean, what's the likelihood of Tom Brady throwing 2 pick sixes in a season? I just believe that he's going to be a difference maker in that regard. And then, you know, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers gave up 128 points off of turnovers. I mean, that's just not going to happen again because I just don't see them in particular throwing 30-plus interceptions as a team. I just don't see that happening and having that contribute to their turnover total. So I think this is a team that, you know, as this defense continues to improve, I think they will continue to improve the offensive line, particularly at right tackle through this draft. And Tom will just make players play better because he has that kind of ability to lift the performance of the people around him. So I think, you know, Vegas is on to something. They're pretty smart out there. They're pretty good at doing those kind of things and making these kind of projections. I think Tampa Bay will be a double-digit win team, sure.
Yeah, those big buildings in Vegas don't exist because most people go there and win. but quickly, Lewis, I would ask you, they have the Saints projected fairly significantly ahead of Tampa in the over-under, I think a game and a half better. Do you still view the Saints as the team to beat in that division despite the presence of Brady?
Yeah, I absolutely do. Look, I think this team is stacked. I think it's been stacked for a while, and I think it's a team that every year continues to get ticked off more and more and more at the way that their seasons end. And coming into this season when you're not going to have any offseason at all, look, Sean Payton himself has alluded to the fact that teams that have continuity on the coaching staff in the front office and in particular on the football field and in particular at quarterback are going to be ahead of the curve. And look, Drew Brees, he is Mr. Saint. He is a Hall of Famer. He's one of the best quarterbacks to ever play. I think the Saints, without a doubt, are the favorites in the South.
All right, we will see. Again, we'll have some more of these over-unders as our morning continues. We're just getting started. Coming up, Chase Young is the type of player that you can build a unit around, but is he a premier pass rusher? Is that the most valuable thing to have on a defense? We'll talk about it in just a few minutes. And then, aside from enormous talent, one thing that made Michael Jordan dominant was his will to win. You'll hear him talking about it in 15 minutes here on Get Up, ESPN.
Hello, this is your apartment. I need some favors from you. Your cat keeps rubbing against the kitchen island, and I can't return the favor. Can you give her extra pets for me? After that, could you bundle your renters and car insurance with Geico? We could save money, and it's easy to do online. And one last thing. Could you leave the TV on during the day? I need to catch up on my soaps.
Geico. For bundling made easy, go to geico.com today.
Foot odor throwing you off your game? Stick to a winning game plan with Odor Eaters, featuring 3 advanced odor and wetness fighters. The lineup provides long-lasting odor control plus more to keep your feet on their game.
Odor Eaters powder provides outstanding moisture control. Clear drying spray is the MVP in preventing athlete's foot, while insoles work continuously to manage wetness while adding a layer of comfort. Pick up today at Walmart, Target, CVS, Dollar General, or other fine retailers.
Odor Eaters. Destroy foot odor with the best in odor defense.
We are back on Get Up, and we are 1 week away from the start of the NFL draft, and there are obviously a lot of questions. The one that everyone seems to answer the same is, which is the best player in this draft? Laura Rutledge, everyone seems to say that's Chase Young, and he was on our show yesterday. He talked a lot about all the film study he does, which I thought was fascinating. Tell us more about what makes him the best player in this draft.
Yeah, he's more of a student of the game than people realize. That's a good point. Here's the thing. Chase Young is the highest graded player in this draft by Scouts Inc. with a 95 grade, which makes him the only tier one prospect, and for good reason.
You don't understand that I am the man. I'm the man.
Chase Young is the best player in this draft, and he knows it.
I know him the best, definitely.
Yeah, he has the highest grade in his class, and he's the only Tier 1 prospect, but there's so much more to Young's greatness.
Chase Young is a game wrecker.
He comes around once every 10 years.
First of all, Chase Young was more productive across the board than Nick Bosa as a collegiate player, even when adjusting for the games Bosa lost because of injury. Yes, you heard that right. Young has more sacks, tackles for loss, and forced fumbles than Bosa. And how about this? Young was the only FBS player in 2019 whose average tackle produced negative yardage.
I know things that I want to achieve. I won't be satisfied until I get them.
So if you're looking for immediate NFL success, Chase Young fits the description. Nick and Joey Bosa both had instant impacts as top five picks, and that 49ers model of building a powerhouse D is a Super Bowl-level bright idea. Let's say the Redskins follow this plan. Young will join a D-line rich with first-rounders and defensive coordinator Jack Del Rio, who helped groom Khalil Mack, Von Miller, and Julius Peppers. Young is a surefire investment, too. Everyone knows a quarterback on a rookie contract is the best deal in the NFL, but an elite edge rusher on a rookie contract works just as well. Nick Bosa, the number two pick in the 2019 draft, has a contract worth $8.4 million annually. That ranks outside the top 25 among current defensive end contracts. What do Bosa, Vic Beasley, Von Miller, Clay Matthews, and Jason Pierre-Paul have in common? They all went to the Super Bowl on rookie deals. In an NFL where everyone is chasing greatness, you'd be nuts to pass on this Buckeye.
So I talked to a team that is not the Redskins and has a pick later in the first round. They told me, Greeny, that if there's a 100% success rate pick in this draft, it absolutely is Chase Young. There are so many teams that wish they had a chance to pick him.
Absolutely. Yeah. He seems to have the highest floor and the highest ceiling. Laura, thank you. We'll come back to you in just a few minutes, but I want to get my defensive players in here. I got Lewis Riddick and Bobby Carpenter, who both play defense in the NFL. So we all understand that Chase Young is considered by most to be the best player in this draft. And then the way our projections go, the next pick in the draft would be Jeff Okuda, who is a shutdown corner. And then after that, Isaiah Simmons, who is like a do-it-all linebacker. So let me ask you this, Lewis. When you are now assessing football, the way it is played in 2020, which of those three positions is the most valuable? The pass rusher, the versatile linebacker, or the shutdown corner?
Yeah, I think being able to affect quarterbacks and make them feel uncomfortable in the pocket and affect their efficiency is the most important thing you can do from a defensive standpoint. So therefore, I think defensive end is the most important position. And I know a lot of work has been done on this as far as what is more important when you're talking about playing championship caliber defense. Is it pass rush or is it coverage? And there are people who will fall on the side of coverage and feel as though that a good corner is better than pass rushers because corner make pass rushers better. Well, obviously pass rush makes defensive backs better. And I've lived through both in my career as a front office. I've been involved in those situations where we actually built the defense from back to front because there weren't available pass rushers, so we really stocked up in the secondary. But I think we've seen in recent times how guys like Von Miller, how guys like Nick Bosa can really change the fortunes of your football team because this has become such a pass-happy league that if you can affect quarterbacks and really cut down on their efficiency and their ability to deliver the football on time, you have gone a long way towards building yourself a championship-caliber defense. So when you have a guy like Chase Young, which is really what this is about, which is he worth the number two overall pick? Heck, is he worth the number one overall pick? I think without a doubt, that's a no-brainer for Washington.
Yeah, he may be the best player regardless of the rest of the discussion. That's the fourth person I've asked that to, and you're the fourth person who has said the pass rusher is the most important thing. So, Bobby, you're my last shot. And the argument I'm trying to make here is that if you have a shutdown corner, of which I think there are fewer than there are great pass rushers, and you have a guy who can just genuinely take the number one receiver from the other team out of the game, again, there are very few of those, I believe that's the most valuable thing to have on a defense in the NFL. Do I have any shot with you?
Greeny, you're probably not. I'm going to go 5 for 5 with this. I'm going to go with Lewis because here's the reason. A quarterback can take out one of the five eligible receivers. So that's big. That's nice. But it's still only one-fifth of the quarterback's passing options. A great defensive pass rusher can impact a quarterback every single play. And if you look back to what Nick Bosa did last year, on his 60 pressures, opposing quarterbacks had a QBR of 5.8. He was absolutely incredibly disruptive. However, when you look at this in a vacuum, I would say that one great pass rusher, that's going to help your team. The reason why Nick Bosa was so good is they already had a really good defensive line. And this is what the Washington Redskins have going for them. They already have a really strong defensive line. And so when you pair that up with Chase Young and you put all those things together, then you're going to have a defensive line that can impact the quarterback in a multitude of ways every single play.
So, Bobby, the order in which we are projecting it to go is Young and then Okuda and then Simmons. Is that the way you would do it?
That's the way I would do it. And I think the reason why is when you look at Simmons, he's the guy that's the most versatile out of all those guys, which is absolutely great. It is fantastic. But you look at defensive coordinators, you look at schemes and head coaches and what they ultimately want to do. Chase Young, he's plug and play, you put him in. Jeffrey Okuda, he's plug and play, you put him in. Those guys you can just line up and let go. Isaiah Simmons is a little bit different because you have to be creative with him and you have to have a coach who's going to buy into his skill and utilize him in a very specific way.
I'm never going to win this argument. Lewis, I'll try you again a little bit later. I got to take a short break here because coming up next, his name still turns heads all these years later. Michael Jordan. You'll hear from him coming up next on his single-minded focus on winning, where it came from, and why he needed it. We also have a moment for Hembo. He's sneaky, and this one is for Bobby, who humiliated himself last week. Which franchise has the longest active drought since drafting a quarterback in the first round? That's the question. The answer is coming up as you get up with us on ESPN.
Though we're apart these days, we're sharing more. So at GEICO, we'd like to say thanks. Thanks for sharing your savage dance moves. Thanks for sharing your DIY haircut fails. Thanks for sharing your inner lip sync star. Now it's our turn to share with the GEICO Give Back, a 15% credit on car and motorcycle policies for current and new customers. Because we're committed for the long haul, the 15% credit lasts your full policy term. Visit geico.com/giveback for more info and eligibility.
We are back on Get Up, and Hembo is putting a bunch of pressure on Bobby Carpenter, who we all agree humiliated himself last week. Bobby, here's the question today. Which franchise has the longest active drought since taking a quarterback in the first round?
I've been racking my brain on this, running through. I can't think of somebody Seattle has drafted. I know the Cowboys took Aikman in 89. That's the furthest back I can go. I feel like I'm getting trolled here again. I'm going with the Cowboys.
Oh, you got to go back a lot farther than that. The answer is the New Orleans Saints have not drafted a quarterback in the first round since Archie Manning in 1971. Hembo is talking trash in your face, Bobby Carpenter. All right, let's go either or here, however, because we can put your expertise to work. Either or, Tua or Justin Herbert, who you got?
I'm going to go with Tua. I know he's hurt. I know he has some of the injury issues, and that can be a problem. But you know what? I've watched Tua do it over the course of his college career. His numbers have been fantastic. Highest career efficiency rating among all quarterbacks in the history of college football. He looks good. The problem is with Herbert, he's big. He's pretty. He checks all the boxes. He's a pretty good quarterback. The problem is there's been some accuracy issues at times. Some of his touch passes, and that's an issue that I have to look at and say, hey, I'm going to give a slight edge to Tua.
Defensive side, Okuda or Simmons? Who you got?
I'm going to go with Jeffrey Okuda. We talked about it in the last segment. I've got Chase Young, I've got Jeffrey Okuda, and then I've got Isaiah Simmons. It's not a knock on Simmons. It's the fact that if I'm a GM, I don't have to worry about who my defensive coordinator is going to be. I can just take Okuda because he's locked up. Simmons is very versatile, but the thing is you have to be able to use him well, or it's just taking a poor school zone.
And then finally, the receivers in this draft are spectacular. Judy or Lamb, who you got?
Judy's fantastic, but I've got to go with Lamb. You know why? I'm watching this guy. He's big. He's physical. He's not the fastest guy top end in the world, but he catches the ball high point. He reminds me of a guy who's been the best receiver in the NFL for the past 3 years, and that's can't guard Michael Thomas. Neither of these guys were testing out in the 40 and were blazers. But they win up at routes, they win at the point of contact, and all they do is make plays.
If your team needs a receiver, this is the draft for you. And 1 week from tonight, you'll be able to see it right here on ESPN. It's also available on NFL Network, and ABC's coverage will focus on the prospects' journey to the draft. You can also watch it all live on ESPN Deportes. You'll hear it on ESPN Radio and on the ESPN app. All right, let's get to the main event. The highly anticipated 10-part documentary series, The Last Dance, debuts on Sunday, capturing the Bulls' sixth and final championship in the Michael Jordan run. And the great Michael Jordan was with Robin Roberts this morning on Good Morning America. Here was that conversation.
First, tell us, how's the family doing? How are you and your loved ones with all that's going on around the world these days? How are you guys doing?
Well, we're blessed, obviously. You know, we get a chance to spend a lot of time together. So I'm quarantined down here in Florida with my wife and my two kids and stay in contact with my other three kids, via the phone. But, my family's doing well. Mom, brothers, sisters, everybody's doing well. So we're very blessed, especially with what's going on in the world. And, look, our hearts and our prayers go out to all the tragedies and the families that are enduring this unbelievable tragedy that's happening to America and to the world.
To the world. And thank you for that. And it's something that people feel, and they're looking for a distraction, if you will. And it's great that this series has been moved up. It was supposed to debut later, but people were just clamoring for something to give them inspiration and hope. And this docuseries really does this. It chronicles that final championship run, that final time that together with the Bulls. Michael, what do you remember most about that final year?
Well, it was a trying year. We all were trying to enjoy that year, knowing that it was coming to an end. I was hoping that, the beginning of the season, it basically started when Jerry Krause told Phil that, he can go 82-0 and he would never get the chance to come back. And, knowing that I married myself to him, obviously, and if he wasn't going to be a coach, then, obviously I wasn't going to play. So Phil started off the year by saying this is the last dance, and we played it that way, so mentally it just kind of, it tugged at you throughout the course of the year, but that this had to come to an end, but it also centered our focus to making sure we end it right. So, as sad as it sounded at the beginning of the year, we tried to rejoice and enjoy the year and finish it off the right way.
And it was quite a year, and the docuseries really profiles that and also goes back and sees, we see a young Michael Jordan. I love seeing your mother and seeing her doing so well. And when you were at North Carolina, like a typical college kid, you wrote her a letter and you were apologizing for the phone bill and asking her to send stamps. What did you learn about yourself during those college years, Michael, that stayed with you?
Well, I think that, it's a little different today. I mean, quite frankly, I had a phone bill that was probably $60 or a little less, and I only had $20 in my account. So, and the thing that, people are going to learn, and, my kids laugh about it when they see it, but we used postage stamps back in those days, I had to ask my mom to send me postage stamps. So, looking at the video, you're going to see a lot of things that people tendly forgot that life was this way. We didn't have Instagram, we didn't have Twitter. So, you had to live life as it came, and each day you preciously protected it and you learn the education aspect, spending time with friends and family. It wasn't via the phone, it was actually in presence, and you wrote letters, So, to me, that's probably the most refreshing thing. That my mom, she kept all my letters. So, it's somewhat embarrassing, but yet it's refreshing that I took the time to write a letter and say, how much I love my mom and, what I needed in college.
Yeah, it was very sweet to hear her read one of your letters like that. And in college, of course, the buzzer beater, 82, winning the national title. You said in the documentary that that was the moment that you went from Mike to Michael Jordan. What did you mean by that?
Well, up until that point, no one knew who I was. I was a college kid other than the university, but outside the university, I was just known as Mike Jordan, and when I hit that shot, my whole name became Michael Jordan. And I think it resonated with a lot of people outside of UNC. So, and I just started piling on that name itself from the successes that I endured, throughout the rest of my career. It wasn't about Michael. It wasn't about Mike. It was more about Michael. Yeah.
Yeah, it really was at that point, and people remember it so well, and they have that iconic shot of yours. We hear from your father as well, and boy, did he know his son. He said, if you want to get the best out of Michael Jordan, you tell him he can't do something. And we're going to show a clip that really personifies that, because it was your second year in the league, and you had an injury. You wanted to get back out on the court. Management had another idea about that and want people to take a look. This is what happened.
Michael asked him, well, if I play, what percentage is there that I'm going to get hurt again? Doctor said, 10%.
And I just lost it. I said, look, it's 10% chance, but it's 90% chance that I won't.
And then I chimed in to the doctors, what happens if the 10% kicks in? And they said, well, then his career would be over.
Well, everybody's just thinking about the negative. Well, I think the glass is half full. Everybody thinking it's half empty.
So I said to Michael, you're not understanding the risk-reward ratio. If you had a terrible headache and I gave you a bottle of pills and 9 of the pills would cure you and 1 of the pills would kill you, would you take a pill?
I look at him, I said, depends on how f-ing bad the headache is.
Okay, I gotta apologize to your mom that we did bleep it out, but sorry that we used that particular clip. I know Dolores is going like, really, really? But where did that perseverance, that drive come from, Michael? Where does it come from?
My parents. My father worked at General Electric for years. He was trying to provide for his family. He moved all over, southern North Carolina. My mom worked for a bank. She worked for Corning Glass. I mean, they were hardworking people. And they instilled that in not just me, but my brothers and sisters. So, I mean, and I just lived vicariously through them and lived and learned it from them. And, it just became a part of my nature, and I always look at a negative and turn it into a positive. Fortunately, things like that happens in our life. And as I try to teach my kid, just take that negative, learn from it and turn it into a positive. And that all came from my parents.
Yeah, and you were keeping up with your brothers as well. We learned that in the docuseries that they, you're a tight-knit family, and they really, really, you guys pushed each other to be the very best, and that's certainly
what you are. Well, I wouldn't be here.
Are,
I wouldn't
very,
be here if it, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for my brother Larry. I mean, Larry pushed me, and we used to fight after every game, but. Through that fight, emerged someone like me, and he's right next to me. He supports me and he works with me and the team, and I would have never gotten this far without him.
Well, thank you. And thank you, Michael. I know you don't do this very often. It really means a lot to get up and to speak with us, and we really, really do appreciate it. And the series is just primo. I know that you're very proud of it. You take care, Michael.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Robin. Thanks for having me.
All right, so that was Michael and Robin this morning on Good Morning America. And the first two episodes of Last Dance will debut on Sunday night on ESPN. I've seen them. It's sensational. And there's a lot of stuff in there that even those of us who covered the teams had never seen before. The uncensored version will be on ESPN and the ESPN app. The edited for mature language version will be on ESPN2. Don't miss it. Meanwhile, we're just getting rolling here. Coming up, college football is weighing options for next year. Playing with no fans or pushing the season back? What do the coaches want? You'll find out next. Do we get up with you on ESPN?
Geico gets you access to licensed agents 24/7, which means that Geico is always there for you. If only everyone was always there for you. Like your mom, when you fill out really, really important paperwork on the first day of a new job.
Name, check. Birthday. Social security, is that a thing? Hey, mom, what is my social security number? Mom? 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 Okay, let's guess. 0017. Oh, Gemini. Hashtag done.
Geico, always there for you with savings and 24/7 access to licensed agents.
We are back on Get Up, and Ohio State coach Ryan Day said all possibilities should be on the table for college football to happen this year, including playing a shortened season that would be conference-only games. Day talked about player safety as one of the biggest concerns.
I think the biggest challenge with that is going to be, if it's not safe for the fans, then how is it safe for the players and for the coaches and those type of people? And hopefully with testing and all the different things that come up over the next couple of months that we're able to answer those questions, but I certainly think it's worth talking about and exploring based on the parameters that are set here over the next, 3 to 4 months.
Boy, this is a complicated issue. In the pros, it's one thing. In college, it's an entirely different conversation. And Laura is back, and you've been talking to a lot of people around the sport. What are they saying about the notion of possibly playing college football games with no fans?
Yeah, this is incredibly complicated, Greeny. And as you heard Ryan Day allude to, they've got to make sure that the players' safety is paramount here. I talked to one college football coach yesterday who said, watch for lawsuits if we try to have players on the field when fans aren't even allowed in stadiums. Not to mention the fact that you've got campuses right now, universities that are closed. So if you're going to say, hey, it's not safe for any of the students on campus to be here, but we're going to try to welcome the players back, that's just going to be very complicated. So as we put out out, there are so many timelines here that are important. The end of May, early June is when all of these conferences, the NCAA is going to come together, put their heads together and reassess all of this. They're looking at if they can ideally try and start on time, it would be July 15th. Ish, where you would try to have players come back to campus. And I think where we have to look at that right now is that a lot of these universities, Greeny, are already closed for the summer. So that timeline may be coming less and less likely. And what I'm hearing is that a lot of conference commissioners are still planning for football in the fall. That's still their ideal scenario. But there's so much here to where they have to put the player safety paramount. They have to avoid what's going to happen potentially from a lawsuit standpoint. And they have to make sure that they're doing what's right by their players.
All right, Laura, I've got a couple of familiar faces to you for sure that were with us this morning as well. Paul Feinbaum and Booger McFarland are here. It is great to see both of you guys. But Paul, I want to start with you on this. What is your thought on the notion of college football games on the field with no fans in the stands?
I think it would be the end of college football as we know it, Greeny. And I don't think it will happen, but if it does, it would further shatter this myth of intercollegiate athletics being amateur. That would be a pure professional sellout. And from what I hear, I do not believe college presidents and commissioners would go for this. I talked to Jimbo Fisher the other day, and he said we have to have football, although he said all the right things in the aftermath of that. But I think it would cheapen the sport. It would just simply devalue everything that college presidents stand up for at orientation and at graduation. And I don't think it would ever recover from that.
What do you think of that, Booger?
Well, Greeny, here's the thing that I would say is how are you going to convince me as a player that it's safe for me to go out there and have hand-to-hand physical combat for 3 hours when it's not safe for the fans to be in the stands who arbitrarily are just sitting there doing nothing? So I understand we all are clamoring for sports. We all want to play football. That's how I made my living. That's how I make my living now. But at some point, common sense has to prevail. And if it's not safe for the fans to sit in the stand 6 inches apart, how in the hell is it safe for me to go out there and bleed and sweat and cry with the guy that's I'm going to be going against? I just don't understand that. And I get it. I understand where we are. But can someone please explain that to me?
Yeah, there's a huge differentiation, I think, for a variety of obvious reasons that you guys are pointing out between the pros coming back and the colleges. Laura, go ahead.
Yeah, well, let me point out a few more things here, guys. Over $4 billion is at stake here in the fiscal year that we will be talking about for these universities. And that's just with the top 50 public institutions in Power 5 programs, Power 5 conferences. So when we're looking at how much money is at stake here, that's another big piece of this. And people say, well, wait a second, the players aren't being paid. How is that even a fair way to look at it? I'm just putting out the facts here of what people looking at this are considering. And when you think about that, in the NFL, the revenue from attendance is about 15 to 16% of their overall revenue. It's a relatively small number. In college, it's at least double that. Some schools, it's even more than that. I talked to one coach who said, look, we're going to make about $105 million per year off of football attendance. And about 80 million comes from attendance and contributions. So you've got to think that attendance and donor contributions go hand in hand. That's incredibly important for all of these schools. And it's why, guys, to throw another haymaker in here, I actually think it's becoming more and more likely that we could see a spring football season beginning sometime in January, maybe February, and then going through early May. And there's a lot of planning that would have to go into that, but it may be the best case to try and have fans in the stands for the revenue perspective.
Correct. Okay, so now we've hit upon the second part of this, which is if it's not safe enough to do it in the fall, do they try to move it to another time? For all the reasons that Laura just pointed out, there's so much money involved here. They're going to find a way to do it if they can. Paul Feinbaum, what do you think of the idea of spring college football?
I think it's even more ridiculous than playing without students or fans. Greeny, how about the Michigan at Northwestern game on January 28th in Evanston? You went to school there. You can't even go outside in Chicago that time of the year. You can't go to a game in Ann Arbor or State College or Madison. And on top of all that, you completely shatter the college basketball season, which I think is unfair to that sport, even though it's a less revenue than football. So of all the ideas that are absurd that I've heard already during this conversation in relation to possibilities, spring football is the worst.
Booger, let's even say for the sake of discussion, they could figure out some of those geographic and logistical issues. would you then be in a position where the teams, the players who were still there, would play a season in the spring and then another season the following fall? They could be playing 20 games in a calendar year. Is that a possibility?
Well, first of all, Greeny, that's the dumbest idea I've ever heard, because in this age of player safety, where we're trying to get the game safer for players, you want 17 to 21-year-olds to play a season in the spring, take about 2 months off, and then come back and play another season. To hell with player safety. Let's just call it what it is. This is all about the money. I hear what Laura's talking about with all the physical implications, but at some point, can we put the money aside and just say this? Are we about safety or we're not? Because if we're not about safety, then let's just stop talking about it. If this is all about money, let's just talk about what it is. We want to make sure from an economic standpoint that we can take care of all the collegiate.
I agree with everything you said. The other side of the argument, and I'm with you, the athletic directors are going to argue if we don't have football, we are getting wiped out. And there's a lot of validity to that argument.
So is it all about the money, or is it about the player's safety? I think that's the thing from a overall humanity standpoint that we have to ask ourselves, because we're trying to play football at all costs, and I get it. We want to be entertained. Football is the fabric of this country. But at some point, can we ask ourselves, we want 17 to 21-year-olds to play basically. I mean, LSU just won a national championship this year. They played 15 games. So we're going to play 15 games in the spring, and then another 15 in the fall, 30 games? Come on, Greeny. You're a great physical specimen as an athlete, and you could even do that. Are you kidding me?
Laura, go ahead.
Wait, okay. Yes, really fast. Let me just throw out a few more things. And the reason why I'm throwing this out, guys, is because this is something that's being talked about, but it's not decided upon at all. They're just trying to figure something out that's going to make some sense. Here's one idea in this. It would only be conference play. It would likely be a shortened season. So if you make it to the college football playoff, that would be the most amount of games you'd play. It'd be around 12 games, maybe. And you're talking about, you know, let's say it ends sometime in early May or sometime in that range. You would take a couple of months off and begin again in the summer. Boog, if you're a team that's played in the college football playoff, you're ending sometime first, second week of January. You're starting back again with spring football and some of those workouts in February. So there's not that much difference from that standpoint. The other thing is they are concerned that they could start a season and have to stop down because of the virus, which would be catastrophic. They cannot afford to do that.
I'm up against the end of an hour here, so I have to leave it, but I want to bring all of you back in the next hour if we can figure out a way to do it, because there's so much here, and I think this is one of the most important conversations around the sports world now. Guys, thank you. Meanwhile, tomorrow night on ESPN2, pardon me, the spotlight is on Peyton Manning as we show you episodes of Peyton's Places surrounding the documentary The Book of Manning. That's tomorrow night, 7 Eastern, on ESPN2 and on the ESPN app. Coming up, Mel Kiper has Tua, the third quarterback taken in the draft a week from today. What do our experts think? We'll ask them next. You're watching Get Up on ESPN.